Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. Today is Bob Dylan's 80th birthday. May he stay forever young. To celebrate, we caught up with Sean Latham, director of the Institute for Bob Dylan Studies and editor of the new essay anthology, The World of Bob Dylan. This program took place May 13th, 2021, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
We're grateful to everyone for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. Our definition of American writing includes not just book authors, but poets, journalists, playwrights, copywriters, and songwriters. Our Bob Dylan exhibit in 2018 honored the great American writer for his contribution to literature, recognized with a Nobel Prize. And we're here tonight to talk about Dylan with Sean Latham, editor of the new book, The World of Bob Dylan. He is the Pauline McFarlane Walter Professor of English at the University of Tulsa, where he serves as director of the Institute for Bob Dylan Studies. He'll be interviewed tonight by Ivan Kane, founding AWM director and first chairman of the program committee at the American Writers Museum, where he helped curate the Bob Dylan Electric exhibit. Welcome to you both.
Hello, Sean.
Hey, Ivan, and thank you very much. This is a pleasure to be here.
Well, our pleasure as well. Before we get into your book, I've got a few outside questions, so to speak. Something big happened in Tulsa around 2016, and it resulted in the formation of the Bob Dylan Institute, which you chair, and also the Bob Dylan Archive and the Bob Dylan Center. Can you talk about what happened and how all these pieces interrelate?
Sure. You know, unexpectedly, I will say unexpectedly for me, I've lived in Tulsa now for just about 20 years. In 2016, the George Kaiser Family Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization based here in Tulsa, whose mission is sort of dedicated to improving the lives of citizens in Tulsa and making Tulsa an exciting place to live, acquired the Bob Dylan Archive, a collection that contains, in some sense, its objects number about 100,000. The catalog for the museum actually contains something like 800,000 entries because there are stems for every recording and all of those sorts of things. So this enormous treasure trove, unexpected treasure trove, no one really knew it existed, was announced and was shortly thereafter moved to Tulsa. It's residing here right now at the Gilcrease Museum temporarily, and will soon move to a new home in downtown Tulsa that will open a year from now called the Bob Dylan Center, which will be a sort of museum experience as well as a home for researchers and a place where the archive itself will actually exist. And as part of that process, we knew we needed, you know, if you have an archive, you need people to do things with that archive. It can't be just a museum. Archives are living things, and they generate new ideas, new work, new art, new scholarship, new kinds of discovery. So my university put together the Bob Dylan Institute, which I direct, and I'll never forget being called in by my university president shortly after the acquisition was made, but long before it was announced. And he said, you know, I've got this exciting news. We've acquired the Bob Dylan Archive, or at least we, in partnership with the GKFF or the George Kaiser Foundation, we've acquired this thing. And you seem to be, I'm a Joyce scholar. I edit the James Joyce Quarterly. I've been working on James Joyce for the first 20 years of my career. He said, you seem to be the guy on campus that knows a lot about how to focus on one person for a long time. So how would you feel about having us focus on Bob Dylan for a while? And with that, my sort of involvement with the Institute began. And we started it up as what will become a home for scholars, for research, and for that kind of work that will go on around the archive.
So were you a secret Dylan admirer at that point, or did you ever incorporate Dylan in your coursework or scholarship? I looked at your CV. I didn't see any Dylan publications before then. Why don't you tell us how this now fits your life?
I like to say I'm a fortunate guy. I didn't come to Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan came to me. You know, I knew I like music. I obviously have spent a lot of time listening to music, and a lot of my work and scholarship has been around popular culture in particular. I was not a secret Bob Dylan fan. I wasn't secretly plotting to spend part of my career now focused on Bob Dylan, but this is a unique opportunity, a new archive, certainly situated square within the field of work that I study. So I've become more and more of a Bob Dylan fan. I was born in 1971, which means my musical taste was being formed in the late 1980s, which was generally considered not Dylan's most creative or interesting period. Just not a lot of great music was being made. It seemed like he was kind of fading into insignificance, that the musical world had sort of passed him by. And so, I mean, when I was growing up, you couldn't turn on the radio and hear a Bob Dylan song on a pop station or anything. I mean, he was on the classic rock stations, and the first Dylan song I heard, and the one that still stands out in my imagination as my first encounter with Dylan, was Rainy Day Women. And that line, "Everybody must get stoned," even when I was like 12, growing up in a very conservative town and in Colorado Springs, I was shocked that you could say that on the radio. You know, even in the 80s, that seemed like a shocking thing to hear on the radio. And so I knew this was a really interesting guy. And of course, I got interested in Tangled Up in Blue and some of those other classic songs after that. But no, I would say, you know, I had not been laying the foundation to become a Dylan expert at all. Rather, this opportunity presented itself. And it's been an incredible pleasure since 2016 coming to, you know, to become an expert in Dylan.
So the Institute supports the archive. Does it also influence what is available at the University of Tulsa? Can I major in Bob Dylan? Can I get a PhD in Bob Dylan? Is that possibly to come?
I'd say you can definitely get degrees in English, which is my own field, and that's where the Institute is essentially housed. And we do have students now that are working on Bob Dylan. So our undergraduate students, one of the things that, you know, my president brought me in for that initial meeting, one of the things he said was, "We need to look like we know what we're doing. So we also need you to teach a course on Bob Dylan so that when they announce the acquisition of the archive, it looks like we're already teaching stuff on Bob Dylan." So I signed up and started teaching that course right away. And that course itself was fascinating. 30 students signed up. I thought I had this amazing first day planned where I had planned we were going to have the discussion of Tangled Up in Blue. I assumed it was a song everybody would know. We could talk about all the interesting things that make it work as a song. And so I get ready and we begin, and it's clear none of the students have ever heard the song or know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. Pivot quickly. Blowing in the Wind. Everybody knows Blowing in the Wind. We can certainly talk about that on the first day.
Yeah.
Still sort of no one had heard of this song except for one kid who raised her hand in the back and said, I know that song, but that's not a Bob Dylan song. That's a Peter, Paul, and Mary song. My grandparents had that, that record. And I thought, okay, we need to rethink. So, I sent them all home. I said, pick one or two of your favorite artists and see if they've covered a Bob Dylan song. I bet they have. And then come back in and we'll chat about those songs. And sure enough, the next class, everybody had found a Bob Dylan song. They couldn't believe that like Adele or whoever like had covered, this was a Bob Dylan song. It's not an Adele song. I can't believe that. And thus did the class launch.
Yeah.
You can come take plenty of classes that are available on Bob Dylan and pop music here that we teach. I've got graduate students that are absolutely working on Bob Dylan. One of them, Nathan Blue, has been slowly opening and cataloging an incredible treasure from the Bob Dylan archive, an enormous bag of U.S. mail, of fan mail from 1966, from the year of the motorcycle accident, that was arrived in Woodstock and Dylan never opened. So these are like little time capsules from 1966, every single one, right? So we're opening these things. You can smell 1966 come out of the envelope practically. And it's sort of amazing to see, to see what he discovered. I mean, you find little stories of people who keep sending letters. You get to see the fandom before and after the accident. So this is just some of the scholarship that our graduate students here are beginning to, you know, are beginning to explore. So absolutely, you can come here and do work on Bob Dylan. It's going to be an absolute center for the study, I think, not just of Bob Dylan, but of Americana or American folk music in general. It's important to remember that the Bob Dylan Center will be basically next door to the Woody Guthrie Center,
right,
which also holds the Woody Guthrie archives. So it's not just Bob Dylan's archive that's here. It's going to be a real
center. You know, I've heard or seen rumors to the effect that Kaiser Foundation and others perhaps are also looking to buy other archives and trying to build on the Dylan and Woody Guthrie synergy. Do you know anything about that, or can you tell us anything about that?
I mean, I certainly can't speak to that specifically. I can say that archives are like magnets. So once Bob Dylan is somewhere, and once Bob Dylan and Woody Guthrie are somewhere, other people are going to want to be near that. The Phil Oakes archive is now here, for example. you know, and when you look at some of the great archives in America, like the Beinecke Center at Yale or the Harry Ransom Humanities Center at the University of Texas, those things exist because they had these sort of core magnets that started, and then people want to be around that because you don't want to have 100 archives scattered around 50 different states. Some people are going to be neglected. You'll lose the ability to make connections. That's just not going to be feasible. So I can't speak for their specific plans, but I would say it's extremely likely that you'll see additional acquisitions that will be coming out of the Dylan Archive, and it will grow into something more significant over the years.
Now, the Bob Dylan Center will be a museum based on the holdings in the archive. I've seen some things, the effect it was going to open in 2021. Is that still on track, or has COVID pushed that off? You know the status of that?
Yeah, absolutely. COVID did push it off, and they just announced yesterday, and I think I have this date right, so we can double check, but I believe May 10th, 2022, it's going to open to great fanfare here in downtown Tulsa. Yes, it was supposed to open this fall, essentially, and COVID just made that complicated for all kinds of reasons. Okay. So it is, you can go downtown, and of course, what does it say on the outside of the building where they're constructing this thing? Something's happening here.
Okay. We don't know what it is. Let's turn to your book.
Sure.
My first comment is that you got the title wrong. And I really got this from your introductory essay, which talks about the worlds of Bob Dylan. Could you talk about what you meant by that?
Yeah, sure. I think that the interesting thing about Dylan, one of the things that makes Dylan so interesting to me, is there's no one right way to think about Bob Dylan. That we all have our own different Dylans, and there's so many different ways you can illuminate his work and its connection to American culture, to American music, to activism, to political history, to civil rights history, to philosophy, to marketing, right? There's not one really way to wrap your mind around Bob Dylan. And so that notion of a world of Bob Dylan or the worlds of Bob Dylan, we want to get this, I've used the metaphor of a prism or a fractal before. And that's why we have a collection here too. This isn't my world of Bob Dylan. This is 27 essays that are gathering together marketing professors, philosophers, music critics, and journalists like Ann Powers and Greil Marcus. We have English professors, music professors, religion professors, right? This is a huge and diverse group of people from around the world that are coming together to say, well, here's how we see Bob Dylan through our prism, and here's how we see it. I'm an expert in country music, right? One of the contributors might say, so here's why Dylan matters to country music. And we put that up against the you know, Gail Wald writing about gospel music, who says, well, here's why Dylan fits into the gospel tradition. And so we're not trying to present a singular Dylan, but rather give people a sense of the richness of him, of his art, his music, his life, his contexts, and his influence. So that's what that world metaphor is meant to capture, that it's just too complex, too many moving parts to ever capture in a single book, a single vision, a single conception of Dylan.
So not a world, but worlds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
I'll see if we can get it retitled for the next edition.
Please do. Now, your anthology, I thought, was carefully curated and is organized into sections. You alluded to some of that organization, but you had sections on creative life, musical context, cultural context, political context, reception, and legacy. I understand the book arose in part from a conference that you had in 2019 with the same title, The World of Bob Dylan. Was the conference organized similarly, or did this organization come out of the pieces contributed for the conference and for the book? How did you fall upon this organization?
I would say that the organization sort of came from me. Like these are the sort of pieces of that world that I wanted to assemble. But it certainly had something to do with that conference in 2019. We were genuinely shocked. Like the conference, had, I mean, the archive acquisition had been announced. We decided we were going to hold a conference here in Tulsa, and we held it in a kind of way that academics hold conferences. We put out a call for papers, and we asked those who might be interested to contribute papers. And we thought we might get maybe 200 academic experts that would come to Tulsa and spend 3 or 4 days having scholarly debates about Tulsa. And What we got instead were 500 people, which was our max capacity. And we had to close registration, I think, 8 weeks in advance or 6 weeks in advance, something like that. And when we looked at the demographics, it was half people who had academic affiliations and half people who didn't. And that was represented not just in the audience, but in the people presenting panels, because we had collectors who have their own kind of expertise that could talk about materials that they had gathered over the course of their careers. We had, you know, people who were lawyers or practicing in other fields, but had very specific kinds of expertise around Bob Dylan, sort of, and the sort of more traditional sorts of academics. So what we discovered and what brought us a great deal of joy really in that conference was finding, you know, here's that world metaphor again, that Dylan isn't just this narrow sort of thing that matters to academics or fans, that we could bring those worlds together, you know, and create this larger community of conversation. And I think everyone came away from the conference feeling this was a community that had kind of been formed, and those boundaries and barriers that often exist between the academic world and the non-academic world just kind of fell away for those 3 days. And we've aimed to do the same thing in this book. That's why we have people who are academics and people who are not academics contributing to the book. And everything in the book is written in a way to be as accessible as possible, right? To convey why Dylan matters in work that's not, as academics can sometimes, you know, fall into, how many angels are dancing on the head of a pin sort of questions. You know, these are meant to be big, broad, expressive essays that are sort of setting the course for what work on Dylan might look like in the future, or be of use to somebody who says, I do know Tangled Up in Blue, but really, a Nobel Prize? You know, why should I care? Why should I really care about Dylan? And this book gives you all kinds of different ways into, as you said, with the organization that's there. I'm interested in country music. Here's a pathway through this book, right? You can skip the stuff on gospel if you want, or find that it actually connects in really interesting ways.
Understand, in the next week or so, you're having another conference, Dylan at 80. Is this going to be a virtual conference, or can you attend this conference? And if you can attend, did you have to think about it differently?
Yeah, it's an entirely virtual conference. So we knew we needed to follow this up. We'd intended to have an in-person conference this year as a follow-on to that first one. Of course, COVID made that an impossibility. But we also knew we didn't want to lose all that energy that had been built up in 2019. And the occasion of the 80th birthday is one for celebration. Few artists make it to this age.
It's later in May, right? Is 80th birthday?
Yeah, it's May 24th. So the which is going to coincide with the conference. The conference will run May 22 to May 24. It's open to everybody. It's virtual, so you can attend from anywhere. And we'll record every session, so the videos will be accessible to everyone who's signed up for the conference asynchronously if you can't make it to the actual event itself. And we'll have musicians at that conference. We're going to have musicians, we're going to have academics, we're going to have collectors, we're going to have people who are building the archives for other musicians like the Grateful Dead and Bruce Springsteen and Leonard Cohen. So it's going to be a sort of another sort of big stock-taking moment, I think. But yeah, it's entirely virtual. We've got about 500 people again registered so far. And they're one of the amazing things, of course, about a virtual conference is that you can bring people in from all over the world. And I think just today we had a registration from Beirut. We've got registrants from Singapore, from down the street here in Tulsa, you know, New York, California. I mean, it's going to be a dazzlingly diverse collection of attendees for the conference, which I think speaks, you know, again, to the power and importance of Dylan. This is not something that's obsessed. It's an obsession for just American music fans or something like that. This is a global phenomenon, and Dylan is a global artist. And we're going to try to take some stock of that at the event as well.
Terrific. I'm going to ask you a couple questions about essays you contributed to the volume.
Sure.
In the introductory essay, you sort of bookended Restless Farewell on Dylan's very first album with the Titanic on Tempest, which was then his last album. Can you discuss the point you were making in bookending those two songs?
Sure. And I can preface it by saying, you know, Dylan really, he really screwed me over because...
The new one.
Yeah, I'd written this great essay. I thought it was a great essay on Tempest. And that Tempest, if you don't know it, it's this song that appeared on then what seemed to be Dylan's last album of original material called Tempest.
Yeah.
Right. Its title comes from Shakespeare's last play, in which Prospero, the sort of alter ego for Shakespeare himself, breaks his wand. A magician breaks his wand and buries it. Shakespeare saying farewell. Here's Dylan saying farewell. The Carter family's last recorded song essentially was a song about the Titanic. So here's Dylan collapsing all those things, Shakespeare, the Carter family, and his own attempt to say farewell, and all at that moment when we're also celebrating the centenary of the sinking of the Titanic, or not celebrating, but marking the centenary of the sinking of the Titanic. So here was Dylan's great farewell song, and I thought it was an amazing song, and it's long, it's 14 minutes long, and the song itself is clearly a way of kind of killing time before time kills you, I suppose is how I would put it. That's why it's so long and seems to want to go on, because it's hard to say goodbye. And then he goes and releases a whole new album of material called Rough and Rowdy Ways, and it's filled with amazing songs. So I had to hastily revise that essay to say it wasn't quite Dylan's last
farewell. What would you, for instance, I contain multitudes might be a valedictory statement by Dylan. There, I'm sure others. If you're writing today, how would you bookend it?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I Contain Multitudes is a good one. I think Crossing the Rubicon on that album is another sort of great attempt to think about farewells. There's a kind of sense on that on this album too of Dylan as a, Dylan's always kind of been a historian. And I should say at the conference, the Dylan at 80 conference, we're going to have Sean Wilentz, the decorated American historian, talking about Bob Dylan as historian and sort of how he treats history musically. And I think, and I can say from the work I've done in the archive, Wilentz is absolutely right. Dylan is a deep researcher. And I think you get a sense on Rough and Rowdy Ways of the depth of Dylan's work, of all the listening that he's done, all the thinking that he's done, all the writing he's done, all the reading he's done, all assembling the past in new and complicated and compelling ways. And ultimately for me, that's what makes Dylan so interesting. So to, you know, I mean, I gave an example there with Tempest and the sort of ways he was could combine Shakespeare and the Carter family and make his own song. And that initial song that you talked about, his first farewell song, Restless Farewell, it too is an assemblage of different kinds of songs. The Parting Glass, a great Scots-Irish song about leaving a bar that's also a song about dying and is a beautiful sentimental Irish ballad he got from the Clancy brothers. He takes that melody, lays over it a kind of his own farewell to the folk world. And this is the song that more so, I think, than Going Electric at Newport is what sort of his attempt to break away from a folk world that I believe Dylan felt was over entangled in nostalgia and couldn't see its way into the future. And Dylan was a guy that was looking to the horizon, not just to the past. He saw the past as a thing you could use to build a highway to the future. And I think you hear that in that Restless Farewell. So Dylan's always saying goodbye, but his goodbyes are always a kind of, I'm saying goodbye because I'm moving on to something else, not because I'm ready to retire. And as we were saying before we went on camera, like go snooze in a hammock and enjoy my fortune.
You described Restless Farewell as the death of the Guthrie persona. I'm wondering if you've ever heard Arlo Guthrie's account of Bob Dylan showing up at his door in 1961.
I have not, no.
I can't tell it as well as Arlo does, and he has quite a touch of fiction on it. But you know, imagine a 10-year-old answering the door, a scruffy 20-year-old or whatever Dylan was at the time is asking for his dad. And he says, my dad's not here, he's in the hospital. So Dylan visits his dad in the hospital, and Arlo says, next thing I know, every song I hear on the radio is by Dylan. And then someone else visited my dad, and every song on the radio was by that someone else. And I wanted to get a musical career started, so I decided I'll go visit my dad. That's Arlo's account. In your songwriting essay, you know, you talk about where do the words come from? And as part of that, you go into what's revealed by the archive. Could you talk about some things you've seen in the archive that speak to Dylan's creative process?
Sure. And you know, that where do the words come from is a question kind of Dylan asks himself too. I mean, it's always the question that writers get asked. I'm married to a novelist. She's constantly being asked, you know, where do you get these ideas? And I believe me, novelists don't have the answers to those questions. They would be writing books a lot faster than they probably do. So asking Dylan that question is the same kind of thing. And that's why people like me exist, is to go see, like to look into the workshop of Daedalus, as it were, to look at Dylan's archive and say, well, here's how I think the pieces might have been made. And I mean, even if you try to explain that to the artists themselves, they'll shrug and say, sure, why not? I guess, you know, I can't tell you how I did it. I just did it.
Yeah.
And what you see in the archive, in my view, as I said, it's this massive thing. And we've long labored, Dylan's fans, I think, in particular, have labored, early fans, labored under the impression and maybe the desire for Dylan to be a romantic poet. That is, that the words did just spring like Athena from his forehead onto the page, out of his soul, from his heart. They express something. And that's what fandom is for, right? Like when you hear those songs that express your first breakup or falling in love with someone new or graduating, these songs create huge emotional connections for you. And you can't ever be rational about them. They're not, that's not how it works. And you know, for someone like me, I can be a little bit more cold about those songs because Dylan was never there to sort of mark the big moments of transition in my life. And so, but I think a lot of people wanted Dylan to have that kind of romantic expression that he spoke my truth for me. And that's why I need him to be this thing. And that's when he decided to play an electric guitar or convert to Christianity. He betrayed me because I didn't do that. He's the guy that was speaking my soul. What does this say about my soul? So, and I think what you actually find when you start to look in the archive, and just that 100,000 number should make this clear, is Dylan was a deep researcher, reader, thinker, reviser, collector of materials. These songs did not jump from his forehead. They were labored onto the page and worked and reworked, many, many, many more set aside than were ever recorded in a studio. You can find lots and lots of false starts, of missteps, things that he abandoned, ideas that are there. You know, so I'll give you an example here. When I was looking in the archive, the thing I've looked at the most closely, because I can't read 100,000 objects, is a collection of small notebooks, just spiral, top-bound spiral notebooks from the basement era, so from 1966 to 1969, and in Woodstock, New York. After he's had this accident, after he's sort of working with the band and creating the Americana genre in some sense. And these notebooks are amazing. They're hundreds of pages just filled with these notes, everyday details, reminder to get, like there's a reminder to get a driver's license, which he doesn't check off, which I mean, I think means he forgot to get his driver's license. Measurements for curtains, and then astonishing lyrics to songs, some of which are a genuine surprise. I'm going to talk about this on a BBC documentary that comes out next week. So I can say, you know, to this audience here, I found an amazing song about his attempt to write a murder ballad about Richard Speck, the mass murderer. So Dylan, that trial, Speck's trial is going on at the time. And here clearly is Dylan thinking, well, Woody could do it with Pretty Boy Floyd, right? Who by another, from one perspective is an outlaw, is a murderer, right? From another is a sort of outlaw hero. So he tried to kind of write a song about Richard Speck and the outlaw and that kind of mode, that tradition. And it doesn't work. It's a fascinating song. And if you listen to the BBC program, I quote from it. So you can hear sort of what the lyrics actually sound like. But there you can see, like, that's just one sliver of some of the stuff Dylan is reading. And he read a lot, clearly, about Speck, about the trial, about the death penalty in America, about questions of justice, about how we know what actually happened when, how poverty shapes crime. All that stuff's in the notebooks. And it gets distilled into this song that never quite emerges. And that's just one little tiny sliver, as I said, of what Dylan's woodshop or woodshed looks like, where he's actually out there making music in the countryside. So there's amazing stuff like that in the archive.
As an aside, I was going to ask you a little bit later about your BBC special, but we can cover it now. I didn't know about it. Is it going to be broadcast here or perhaps at a later date, or when can we see it?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it'll be broadcast here. It's going to be on BBC Four, which is the radio station. Starting next week, it's going to be a 5-part series. So it'll play all week and it'll be a podcast. You'll be able to find it on the BBC website if you just go looking for Dylan. I think it's called It Ain't Me, Babe is the name of the series. And so you'll hear me make probably some of the same points you've heard me make today. But yeah, it's going to be, I think, a really interesting 5-part look at the fullness of Dylan's creative life and his work as a songwriter.
Well, before we go to some of the other contributors, you made two other points that I wanted to talk briefly about it. You mentioned that his career seems to move from stale periods to outbursts of creativity. So, for instance, from after Blonde on Blonde and the motorcycle accident, he kind of seemed to have a foul period, including such duds like Self-Portrait. But out of that comes Blood on the Tracks. And there are other instances of he went through the Christian period, which at least a lot of the public, a lot of, you know, some critics don't hold highly, but then he came to another high after that. And he seems to use these fallow times to build up reserves for an outburst to come. I guess I'm just summarizing your point, but he really does have a career that has peaks and valleys, but he, during the valleys, he seems to be busy.
Yeah. And I think you see that in those notebooks that I described in Woodstock, that's Dylan doing the research. And my own view of this is one, I would take issue actually with your characterization of the Christian period. I actually think that's Dylan exploring gospel music. And that's actually one of the most interesting parts of his career, especially when you think about Dylan and race. He stops thinking about blackness in America as simply being about suffering and starts thinking about blackness as a resource for community and uplift. And I think that makes that Christian period far more interesting than we've given it credit for. But I think you're right that, and the way I see it is what Dylan does is when he starts to feel like his creative power, his creative engine is running down, he starts listening to old stuff again. And that stuff always changes, whatever it is. So the first thing they do when they get together in the basement, for example, before you get things like John Wesley Harding, right, is just record a bunch of old folk songs. And they're teaching each other music. So, you know, Levon Helm is teaching him, Robbie Robertson is teaching Dylan some songs, Dylan's teaching Robbie Robertson songs. They're just learning from each other different folk traditions. And you get this kind of period of research and covers that then let Dylan start writing based on what he's learned from inhabiting these old songs. I think you see the same thing at that remarkable moment where you get those folk songs, those folk cover albums in the late 90s, like Good As I've Been to You, that then become the springboard to Love and Theft in 2001 into that late career renaissance that I would argue is the reason Dylan won the Nobel Prize. If his career had ended in the 80s, 90s, there was no Nobel Prize waiting there. It was these late albums and the ability to still be creative and still make astonishing stuff. And I think now with Rough and Rowdy Ways, he spent the last few years covering crooners, right? Covering this kind of gentler music of the 1950s, this other vision of America in song that's long been seen as the opposite of rock, right? It's just this thing that's the antithesis of the Dylan world. When in fact, Dylan says, this is what I was listening to at the same time I was listening to Little Richard. He works through all this material and then we get this great new Bob Dylan album. So I think what we hear is Dylan not so much losing his energy so much as needing to go back and do more research to investigate another branch of American popular music and see what he can do with it when he learns its language, its musical language, its lyrical language, and so on.
Okay. Well, finally, you had a phrase, something like his endless tour is, you know, the ultimate Dylan long form as opposed to a recorded album. Can you just very briefly tell us what you meant by that?
Sure. I mean, I think the one thing that you see again when I look in those notebooks, and this is another discovery that comes out of those notebooks that I haven't talked about in 1966 to 68, is Dylan's actually tries to go back and rewrite some of his old songs, including The Times They Are a Changin'. He tries to write an additional response song called The Times Have Changed. And he goes back and he tries to create new lyrics for Highway 61 Revisited and others. He's literally going to go back and rewrite the old songs. And clearly what he decides at that point is not to do that, but to instead cover those songs in new ways, right? And this is when you go to a Dylan concert, if you've been, you know, this is the experience. You go and you hear this kind of weird surf rock boogie start, only to realize 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes into the song that you're listening to like a Rolling Stone or one of his most famous songs. And Dylan is, I think instead of deciding to rewrite lyrics, he decided he would spend the rest of his career re-exploring his own songs, understanding himself as having become a part of musical history. So he could start doing research on himself, right? Like, what would it have been like if I'd been a surf rocker? You know, what would those songs have sounded like? And that's that's an amazing kind of experimental form. So to see Dylan is constantly rewriting his own songs is a fascinating experiment, because it's Dylan understanding himself as part of musical history and then working on that history, right? So there's a kind of Hall of Mirrors effect, I guess, but it suggests something about the ways in which he keeps wanting to go back to the past and transform it to make it useful for the future.
Tell us about a few of your favorite pieces from the book. I'm not authored by you, but by your contributors. After you give me a few examples, I'll give you a few of mine. You can react to them.
Sure. I hope they're not listening, because it's like picking your favorite children or something. But I mean, I'd say one of the chapters that I'm really pleased with is the one by Ann Powers on Dylan's body and Dylan and gender. It has the winning line of the whole.
Only be written by a woman.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it has the best line in the whole book, which is sometime around 1975, Bob Dylan took his shirt off. And she, you know, what she does is go through and talk about the sort of soft cuteness of the young Dylan, the mod, angular body of the mid 60s, the country gentleman, the sort of late age rocker, and then how he inhabits his aged body now. And it's a fascinating meditation on Dylan's response to masculinity. Like, why does he not look like the Rolling Stones? How does he inhabit ideas of being a man, of being a masculine rock star, in ways that are different than the rest of the world around him? And what does that tell us about him? So I think that's a phenomenal essay. I think there's a great essay in there by Michael Kramer, which also makes use of the archive on Dylan and the counterculture the 1960s, which I found to be, because it's drawing on original material from the archive, is really rich.
We said John Wesley Harding was a response to Sergeant Pepper. So it's counterculture.
Absolutely. Counterculture.
Right.
But yeah, man, I think they're all really great. I do love Gail Wald's essay. I already mentioned it, on gospel music, because I think it does take that Christian era seriously and can do it in a way that says, we have to understand that gospel music's about race, right? And so to see Dylan's Christian period as somehow a betrayal of religion is to misunderstand how Dylan is constantly thinking about the racial history of music, about the fact that all popular music in America, in some ways, historically anyway, rests on the minstrel show. That there, and Dylan makes this clear in that title of that album, Love and Theft, and in songs like Blind Willie McTell. He's never not aware of the fact that popular music and rock music in particular is built around the appropriation of black sounds and black voices. And so to think about that in terms of the gospel tradition, as Gail does in that essay, I think is a really important step for us as Dylan fans, as Dylan listeners, to understand that race is always something he's thinking about in his music. And we know he's a dedicated civil rights activist and always has been. And we shouldn't be surprised that actually forms an important part of his musical exploration as well.
I really liked, I think Devin Powers did a bit on the Bob Dylan brand. And, you know, you think about it, before he came to New York, he renamed himself. and as soon as he had a house, he began gathering an archive. And he's always had very aggressive management. Everything he's done in his career contributes to the brand. Yet his brand is that he's not a brand. It's you know, very, you know, Dylan-esque, I'll say. Another one I like, just for perverse academic reasons, was Kevin Detmer's piece.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a perverse academic person myself, not in my job, but in my background. And he was an English professor's brilliant explication of a Dylan song using modern scholarship tools. And he uses, you know, digital humanities, basically a computer program, looking at the word lonesome and how it's been used compared to lonely, alone, you know, other synonyms. And turns out lonesome is mostly used only in songs, particularly by Hank Williams. And he looks at Dylan's "You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You're Gone," which always was curious to me because it doesn't sound lonesome. And he says, well, that's because it's not a breakup song. It's a song about breakup songs, which is why he's using lonesome out of the Hank Williams vocabulary. And I thought that was just terrific. Sometimes you academics can get way out there, but sometimes you're right on. So I thought that was just great. Is there anyone that you included that you don't agree with, but you included just because you thought their point of view was worth considering?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, there are certainly people here that could only write these things because I don't know very much about it. I'm not sure there's anything in there that I necessarily disagree with. But it was a pleasure to hear sort of someone like Elliot Wolfson, who's a very decorated religion scholar, scholar of Judaism, sort of reflect on Dylan and Judaism from that vantage. I found that to be a very interesting essay. And I think we came away really, really pleased with the essay by Larry Starr on the Great American Songbook, which I suppose to me, if there was like a period of Dylan's career where I've just been like, I guess so, fine. I mean, I'll still listen to it, but I'm probably not going to put it on my record player on the weekends, or those sort of those covers of the Tin Pan Alley songs that he did for a while. And Starr makes a really interesting case for why that's been an important part of Dylan's output. So I don't necessarily disagree with what Starr says, but one of the great things with a volume like this is I keep learning something every time a new essay would come in. Like, I got a new world of Dylan to discover, essentially, in the essay.
Yeah, that's terrific. So Dylan famously won the Nobel Prize, and Jane English contributed a great essay on that. She made two points I liked. One is she noted that Dylan ended a 23-year freeze on American laureates, but in choosing Dylan, it let the Nobel Academy remain aloof from the American literary mainstream, because he's a songwriter. He's not an American novelist. He's not Philip Roth. Now, you're also part of the academic community, and as part of that, part of the Bob Dylan community. What do you think? Categorically, does a Nobel Prize fit? Does he deserve a Nobel Prize?
That's such an interesting question. I mean, the shortest answer I can give is, yeah, absolutely, as much as anybody else does. And if one of the things the Nobel Prize is supposed to measure is the effect of one writer on the whole of literary culture and on the culture as a whole, I think, as you heard from many other Nobel laureates who won the prize, Salman Rushdie and Katsuo Ishiguro among them, saying, I'm so glad Dylan won the prize. Like, we listened to Dylan and he taught us how to do things with words. We taught us about how to mix high and low kinds of culture, or pop culture and serious literary culture. Dylan did that first. We then did it in books, but Dylan taught us how. He deserves a Nobel Prize because he taught us the technique. Yeah. Right. And so I think in that sense, Dylan absolutely deserves the Nobel Prize. Now, as you know, Dylan himself didn't. It took him 2 weeks to accept the prize. And his acceptance speech is quite ambiguous. And it concludes by saying, I'm not really sure I wanted it because I'm not really sure I'm a writer. I'm a performer. I want my words to live on in performance, not on the page. Right. That's the last paragraph, the last lines of his speech. And I think that's also an important thing to consider is he definitely had, as a Nobel laureate, absolutely. Is that the most important thing Dylan did? No, I think he's right that there's, as I said earlier, I'm a James Joyce scholar. I'll say this. There's no such thing as a cover of Ulysses. Ulysses is done. It's on the page, right? It's there for us to read. Nobody's going to cover it again and find something new in it. A Dylan song is amazing because, as he said, it lives in performance, and therefore it's this treasure that keeps on growing. The more that people cover it, the richer the song becomes. And that's a unique addition, I think, that Dylan can make to our culture as well.
You know, that having been said in the same speech, he said, I'm just a performer, like Shakespeare, like Homer, which of course are paragons of literature, although it is performed literature. And I think he was kind of ironically undercutting his statement that I'm just a performer. So I think he was having his cake and eating it too.
Oh, I think that's absolutely fair. Yeah.
So this book is one of the first books in which some of the essays use material from the archive. How do you think the archive is going to change Bob Dylan's studies?
I think I can answer that question in two ways. The first is to say, as I said, we're just going to learn so much more about how he actually made the songs, and we're going to learn about all the songs that didn't come out. And it'll take a while because those songs are still incredibly valuable pieces of intellectual property, right? A new Bob Dylan lyric being released tomorrow is is a bankable product. So we'll see into the workshop, and that'll be an important thing for us to do to understand how Dylan made the songs and how they connect to this much larger cultural world. And so, you know, in that sense, we're going to have all of that kind of, as I said, peering into the workshop of Daedalus. But I think it's also true that another thing that archives like this allow us to do is sort of do some sorting. It's true that 50 years from now, we'll have one or two or three, maybe, performers like Dylan from this era that we study and that we remember. That's not to say we'll forget everyone else, but it's the nature of literary history and how teaching works, right? I mean, these things live on because they live on in part in the classroom, and we'll decide who is it that's worth teaching and why. And I think by getting his archive out there early, by making it available to scholars, and by showing its depth and richness, Dylan is making his bid in part for being the one that we teach mid-century American popular music. It's going to be Dylan and the Beatles, probably, or Dylan and Joan Baez, or, you know, it's going to, or maybe Dylan and Prince, right? There'll be only a few. And you can sustain that work and the teaching around it because you can always be going back to the archive to find more and more and more material. So I think it has both of those purposes and goals.
I understand you're in the early stages of working on a Dylan biography. And is that right? And what do you hope to contribute to Dylan scholarship?
Well, I'd initially conceived this. I'm here at the archive. I've got all this material. And I initially conceived it. I'll say, you know, in my own scholarship, I'm not particularly interested in the details of Dylan's personal life. But I am deeply interested in Dylan as a creative artist. That is how he made the stuff, what we call genetic criticism in the academy. And so my plan is to write a biography about how Dylan made the songs and to use the archive to show that process happening. And it covers a lot of the material that we discussed here tonight. I'll say that having gone through these notebooks from that Woodstock era that I've talked about, that's a book unto itself. Greil Marcus was onto something when he called it Dylan's Encounter with Old Weird America. He knew something important had happened down there. He needs access to this material as well. I want to write the kind of follow-up to that book because we're going to see it's even deeper and richer and more complex, and there was so much more going on in those notebooks than we could have imagined. So that biography may at first have to shrink down to just look at those years because there's so much there. And I think that's going to be what anybody finds when they start digging into the archive, is you think you're going to have a big story to tell, and it's why we have 27 essays in this book. There are actually 27 different stories to tell about Dylan, depending on how you look at the material in the archive.
Well, we look forward to seeing them, and I hope we can feature them at the American Writers Museum. I'm going to turn the podium back to Allison.
Well, I want to thank both of you for this conversation tonight. Do either of you have any final thoughts you'd like to share?
All yours, Sean.
Well, I would just like to say thank you to you guys for hosting us. As I was saying before we came on the air, I think the American Writers Museum is great. It was actually Chicago was the last place I visited before the pandemic started, and I had a chance to see the exhibition on Dylan while it was up there. It was a phenomenal thing, and it's a terrific museum. These kinds of cultural institutions are absolutely fundamental to remembering our past and making it useful for the future. So I'm really grateful I had the opportunity to chat with you guys about Dylan tonight.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Tune in next week for a fascinating discussion between writers Nicole Chung and Rebecca Mackay about Chung's memoir, All You Can Ever Know. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.